Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Michael Perrenti. I don't think Michael needs an introduction, but for the few people who may not know as much about him as they should, Michael is an internationally renowned award-winning author and lecturer. He's a leading progressive political analyst. We want to talk about world and national issues with Michael today. He's also a valued contributor to the book that I had the honor to edit and contribute to, called Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III, and maybe I'll be the first to mention Michael's forthcoming book in the spring. Before the program, Michael said he's completed the writing of the book. He calls it Prophet Pathology and Other Indecencies, and he describes it as a collection of themes relating to present-day iniquities. He gave me a little bit more information about it, but I think you get a little bit of the idea of what the book is. It'll be out in the spring, and all I can say is this. I've read nearly all of Michael's books. I've only missed a few. Oh, it's a couple of dozen of them or so. I've read about 20 of them. Those books gave me an education I wouldn't sacrifice for anything. Whenever Michael comes out with a new book, it's must reading. So I absolutely recommend, write the name of the book down, Prophet Pathology and Other Indecencies, and Michael will put it on his website when it gets a little bit closer to publication. And if you just Google Michael's name, Michael Perrenti, you'll find his website, you'll find his other books, and before too long, you'll find information about this one, maybe the end of the year or early next year, and you can put it on your list as books to buy. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you, Steve?
Oh, I'm doing fine, Michael. It's great to have you on. There's so much going on. Maybe a good point to start would be what Obama probably will say tonight when he goes on national television. And I wrote an article I got out yesterday, and I called it Obama Intends Escalating Middle East Aggression. There's no question about that. He's going to justify the unjustifiable. Your comments about it?
Well, he's already aggressed in the Middle East. He's waged a war against Libya and destroyed that country, and he's waging a war against Syria now, and of course, Iraq is being done over again now with the Islam. What do they call IS?
Yes.
Islam State.
Yeah, Islamic State. Either ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State.
Right.
They call themselves the Islamic State.
Yeah, yeah. And his statements I can't give too much attention to because I just don't believe any of them. They're just all the purpose of all of his statements are simply to engineer appearances of PR control. And I think we're in for a long haul with the Middle East, and IS has come along now, and they're perfect. They're a perfect villain. We need this like we need poison, you know, and this will justify more military intervention, more bombings, and the like. So nothing to be happy about. Nothing really to report from the Middle East that is hopeful or taking a good turn in any way, because what those people need is peace. They just need peace. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands who have lost their homes and everything, their social structure, and they're living now in destitution as refugees, displaced persons, we used to call them after World War II, and that's what we have here.
We sure do, Michael. In the post-9/11 era, it's been nonstop war, starting with Afghanistan, and of course all the others that followed, Iraq for the second time. Now Obama is waging the third Iraq war, the right. War with Libya, Obama's proxy war against Syria. The notion that
Potential targeting of Iran that's been put on the shelf for now. But
absolutely.
But that's still another target.
The idea is to first eliminate the Assad regime in Syria, isolate Iran, and then go after the Islamic Republic. That's been the plan for a long time, and there have been war plans drawn up and redrawn up and revised many times over the years. But absolutely, regime change in both Syria and Iran are very much part of America's agenda. And the notion, Michael, is that America tolerates no sovereign independent countries. They want them all to be pro-Western stooge governments, and Iran is independent. Syria is independent. Saddam Hussein was independent. Afghanistan was independent. Gaddafi was independent. You go right down the line, and any country that isn't subservient to U.S. interests gets targeted for regime change.
I wrote about that in my book, The Face of Imperialism, where I pointed out that the empire tolerates or perceives only two types of countries on its perimeter, and that's the satellites. The countries that obey and stay along, or sometimes call allies too, or potential enemies. If you're not a complete satellite to the empire, you're a potential enemy. If you dare to chart an independent course of your own, then this is seen as an act of oppression. And the real problem, of course, is then with countries that are so large that it's not easy to turn them into satellites, as China and Russia, for instance. So this, we could add Russia to this scene, and Ukraine, of course. And so this is what we're facing right now.
Yeah, it's so true. Michael, I call Russia and China the final frontier, absolutely independent countries and very powerful countries. China, of course, an economic juggernaut that in some years ahead will catch and pass America as the world's leading economy. Not yet, but it's heading in that direction. And it's also a powerful military country. And Russia is the only country that can match America's nuclear arsenal blow for blow, including delivery systems that have pinpoint accuracy. The idea of a potential war with Russia, Michael, is absolute madness, but it's very possible that something like that could happen.
Yeah, possible. I noticed Porchenko. Is that his name, Porchenko?
Poroshenko.
Poroshenko.
I've written his name so many times in articles. Petro Poroshenko. They call him the
Poroshenko.
Chocolate King.
Is the puppet president of Ukraine. And you know, he's a right-wing... right-wing mouthpiece. Now, in May, June, July, in August it was too. Well, at least three times, maybe four, he called for ceasefire, and then was the first to break it and violate the ceasefire because he was making gains. His troops were moving in East Ukraine. This last time now, this September call for ceasefire, he's adhering to it because he's losing. He's getting his ass whooped now, and so this time he probably will observe the ceasefire.
I think he will for a time. Of course, there's still some fighting going on, sporadic fighting. You get these right sector neo-Nazi thugs that have their own battalions, Michael, and they're the ones, I think, that are causing the disruptions. And I believe that the self-defense forces have held back and haven't really done much, but one of the elitists made a comment that if this stuff continues, they will respond with quote-unquote deadly force. And you're exactly right, Michael. The Ukrainian military was making gains at the beginning, and in recent weeks they've had their ass whooped. They're in disarray. They've lost, I don't know how many men they've lost, but they've lost many of their forces. The military is in disarray, and there's no will to fight. The kids that are sent over there to fight want nothing to do with killing other Ukrainians. Some of them desert. Some of them cross the border to Russia for safety. And so the whole military situation for Kiev is really disrupted. Their plans are just totally out of sync. So the only thing they could do is call a halt to fighting, which I believe is temporary, to regroup, and then they'll come back and do what they want to do. Obama doesn't want peace. He wants war.
Well, he wants a triumphant outcome for the empire.
Yes.
And they'll pursue it with peace and conferences and treaties, or they'll pursue it with bombs and planes and tanks. whichever way, or a combination of those things, whichever way will get them what they want. They'll do anything, and give pretense of being. Of being devoted to peace and justice and salvation for the Ukrainian people. It's again and again they do it, and again the American public seems to fall for it. And of course, again and again, the U.S. media just so obligingly goes down the line of the official propaganda line, you know. I heard two female commentators on NPR talking about Mr. Putin and just speaking with their voices dripping with sarcasm. And, you know, I've never heard what Putin has had to say. I've never heard it on U.S. media. They never actually quote his statements because his statements have been pretty reasonable. He doesn't want a war with, and he doesn't want half of Ukraine pouring into Russia right now, and he doesn't want to have huge numbers of regular troops in eastern Ukraine. I mean, Russian troops. So it's amazing how the U.S. media will just continually. With the snap of the fingers, they'll follow the line that comes out of the national security state. That is their job, which is to defend the national security state. And our leaders then just demonize the particular leader. In this case, it's Putin. And you demonize the leader, and this justifies intervention. And we are, it assumes we're taking a virtuous role here in saving these poor, defenseless people.
Michael, in one of my articles, I forget which one, I quoted you from your book, Inventing Reality.
Mm-hmm.
Inventing Reality, right? About the FCC.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the book, about a former FCC commissioner recommending that we talk back to our television sets. And your comment was that, they just manipulate the public mind to go along with the agenda that they want to pursue, and they convince people to go against their own self-interest. I love quoting you. I quoted you from that book. I quoted you, your definition of imperialism. But this is true. But the big lies that have circulated about Russia with regard to Ukraine, we've both heard some awful big lies repeated over and over again. I don't think I've heard any more repetitious and vicious, malicious than the big lies that circulate about Russia. Both Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, from the beginning of the conflict, have gone all out for a diplomatic resolution. And there is no evidence whatever that shows Russian troops cross the border, or Russia is arming the self-defense forces, or Russian artillery is firing from within Ukrainian territory, or cross border from Russian territory. These are fabricated big lies, but they keep repeating over and over again. And even some intelligent Americans, Michael, believe this rubbish because they never hear anything else.
Well, they must be getting some aid from Russia, don't you think so? I mean, just between you and me, they must be getting some arms and some
ammunition. Russian volunteers who have come over, retired military personnel. Where they're getting most of their weapons is the desertion.
I think they have every right to get some things.
Oh, I think they do, too. But there are large numbers of Ukrainian forces deserting, Michael. They're dropping their weapons. They're leaving. And the self-defense forces have picked up tanks and artillery that these people left behind.
Yeah.
That's where they're getting their weapons.
Yeah, because they do have pretty good arms. They have assault rifles.
Oh, they don't have
old shotguns or hunting rifles or something, you know, like a people's makeshift army or something. They seem to have some pretty good weapons.
They really
do. Which I think is good. That's all, because they're fighting off this fascist regime here, this puppet imperial regime.
Well, I've said many times in articles, they deserve universal support. These are people who reject fascism. And they have every right to reject fascism. The only thing they want is real democracy, and they want the kind of local autonomy that U.S. states and cities have. In other words, to elect their own mayors, their own governors, their own city councils. And right now, Kiev appoints these officials. They want the end of that. They want the right to pick their own leaders, and they have every right to want that and to get that.
Absolutely correct. Yes.
The other big dimension, Michael, is the Ukrainian military, the ones in the ranks, the soldiers in the ranks, they have no incentive in the world to fight. They want to be home. They're being very poorly treated. They're ill-clothed. They're ill-fed. They're ill-treated. They don't want
and
to be
there. And they're getting killed, and they don't want to get killed. That's really the big deterrent. You know, getting killed really takes the rim off the joy of it all, you know, it really does.
Well, that is the big dimension. But the self-defense forces have every incentive to fight for their freedoms that they want and deserve, and that's the big equalizer in this war. So they turned it around, and they just mauled the Ukrainian military, and that's when the propaganda started about Russian troops crossing the border. Well, Russian troops didn't cross the border. Where's the evidence? There is no evidence. It's made up. NATO repeats it. The U.S. media repeat it. Western European governments repeat it. The Eastern European governments repeat it. The only thing they don't provide is the proof.
Yeah, well, there may be some advisors, there may be some volunteers. And
there are volunteers.
There aren't regular troops in substance at regiment's strength or something like this with tanks and heavy artillery and the like. That's a lot of baloney. And, I mean, that would probably be something Putin isn't raring to do. And he's also called the aggressor and theft of Crimea. Well, Crimea was Russian for 200 years. In 1954, Nikita Khrushchev, himself a Ukrainian, gave Crimea to Ukraine when Ukraine was not an independent country but a Soviet republic. And so here again, I would have to say Crimea is totally, just about totally populated with Russians, and they all wanted to become part of Russia. There was no question at all there.
Oh, indeed. I think it was in May they held a referendum that independent monitors judged open, free, and fair. And I still remember the percentage, Michael.
96.77%
of Crimeans voted to join Russia.
96,
I mean, that's almost unanimity.
Did you say 96%?
96.77%.
Well, I thought it was 93%. Wow. Well, that's quite a bit. That's
even
a low-hanging fruit. I mean, Crimea was meant to be with Russia, yeah.
Well, I mean, the people wanted it. All Putin did was accommodate their wishes, and the turnout was 82%. 82%. So even the non-Russian population, a lot of them wanted to join Russia. What's going on in Ukraine with the fascist regime in Kiev, you could see why the Crimeans wanted nothing to do with that. So Putin didn't invade Crimea. He didn't, as the propaganda says, annex it. He simply accommodated the wishes of the vast majority of Crimeans. I don't know how he could have done anything less.
I was interviewed by a young man who is an American. I can't tell you what was the network or the station, only because I can't remember it right now. I could look it up, but I don't have the stuff handy. He was in Crimea recently, and he said the people are really happy that they're part of Russia again, that their pensions seem more secure, and the situation, the food supplies, this, that, the other thing, they said that when they were part of Ukraine, the roads weren't getting fixed, nothing was working, the level of standard of living was really low, and so they really feel they're really putting themselves to fixing the place up now, it seems. That's good news, it sounds like. I mean, you don't hear a word of that in the Western media, though.
Well, that's exactly right.
The mainstream media, I mean.
A lot is getting done in Crimea, and I think a lot more will be done. Putin is committed to helping the Crimean people, boosting its economy, upgrading its infrastructure, doing vital things like that.
Right.
Ukraine was doing nothing.
Desperately needed work.
Yeah. Ukraine's economy has always been in the dumper, at least it has been for a very long time. But since crisis conditions broke months earlier, the economy is broke. Its GDP may decline as much as 15%.
Oh, I predicted this a month ago, Stephen, yes, and you have too, which is it's they're really going to pay. Oh, they're going to pay. They're going to get an IMF debt now of about, $16, $17 billion. And the debt will be theirs to pay, and the benefits from that money, I don't know where it goes. It doesn't seem to trickle down.
A lot of it is being stolen, Michael.
To move on to other things, and another dramatic development was the Massachusetts DA who refused to prosecute those two young men in a lobster boat who were trying to stop delivery of coal, wasn't it? And the DA's announcement that we're in a terrible crisis as far as the carbon dioxide level is increasing dramatically. 2013 and now this year, it's going up. The Antarctic shelf is broken off, and this could lead to a 10-foot increase in sea level. If a 10-foot increase in sea level will destroy just about every country that has a coastal side to them, people don't realize that. They say, "Well, I'm safe. I'm 20 feet above sea level." Well, that's not the way it works. If your bays and your docks and your shipping is destroyed, you don't get anything to live off after that. You know, it will be in this book I wrote, the one you're mentioning, Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. I have a chapter called Profit Pathology and Disposable Planet. I think it's the last chapter of the book, and we are really facing a disaster of momentous proportions, and I wish people would stop saying, "And our grandchildren will get our grand." It's something about evoking or referring to grandchildren that's supposed to be so heart wrenching. That's baloney. You tell 20-year-olds your grandchildren will. That's 50 years away. That they can't really focus that urgently when they're trying to pay their college tuition debt and all that. It's not grandchildren. It's right now. And that's what people are beginning to say at last. And I've been saying it for some years now. It's right now the crisis is momentous, and it's happening right now. The CO2 buildup, the oxygen, the decline in oxygen in the atmosphere. You know, I mean, one gallon of gasoline burns up, I don't know how many cubic pounds of oxygen in the air. It's frightful. You wonder how are we still breathing? So we have that crisis to meet. Not this thing about by the end of this century it's going to be very bad. It's really the end of this century. Everybody that's walking around now, by the end of this century, will be dead. That's another 80 years away, most everybody. So it's really, this thing is happening right now. It's momentous. And our leaders have shown no interest in really coming to grips with it. Obama has made some utterances and a few little pretty speeches about being concerned, and we have to give this consideration. But there's nothing they're really doing as far as fossil fuel and as far as nuclear power being a terrible danger. There's going to be more than one Fukushima if we don't watch out. So So these are all momentous questions, and we don't get any attention given to them, let alone solutions. And instead, we get Republicans in Congress who are worrying about morning after pills and how to close down another abortion clinic. And this is where they're fighting. Meanwhile, the whole world is going to hell.
It really is, Michael. I had a radio interview where we talked about some of this, and we mentioned the fact that up in the universe, there's this marvelous source of limitless energy, free energy. It's called the sun. All we need to do is develop the technology. We can make it dirt cheap. We can have free energy. We can have clean energy, and we can save the planet at the same time. But nobody does that. You can't put a meter on the sun, so it's the reason nothing much goes in that development. Although solar panels are a lot cheaper than they were years earlier, but still nothing is being done to go all out to replace what's destroying the planet with what can save it.
Yes, absolutely, Stephen. So I thought by now you would have come up with a solution of some kind, but I guess I'm going to have to wait.
Oh, maybe in another life, Michael.
But
this is certainly a major, major issue. If the wars don't destroy us, the environmental degradation for sure will.
Yeah. Well, I think that DA did something though. He actually refused to prosecute. In other words, he said there was a larger issue than this particular issue of the immediate lawful or unlawful nature of the action they took in blocking the coal delivery with a lobster boat or something, that he said this is behind more and above all this is this larger crisis, and I'm not going to be on the side of those who perpetrate this crisis. And that's good if that can start happening. If we can get more and more of our army acting like the Ukrainian army, that might be good. You know, just saying we're not fighting, we're not going to do this, we're not going to go here, or whatever. Although when you get something like the Islam State, suddenly you actually find someone who's even worse than the empire. I mean, crazy, murderous, a fanatical group, but marvelous enemy, fit right to justify continued U.S. bombings and intrusions and interventions all through the Middle East.
Well, what's never mentioned about the Islamic State, Michael, is it's a U.S. creation, just the way the Mujahideen were in the 1980s, mm-hmm. The people that Ronald Reagan called the moral equivalent of our founding fathers.
Yeah, remember that. Yeah.
in the White House, face-to-face with their leaders, and Al-Qaeda, a modern-day equivalent of the Mujahideen, and other offshoots, Al-Nusra, and now the Islamic State. And the Islamic State admits, and I think there's a lot of evidence to back this up, let me put it this way, it certainly is no secret that American Special Forces and CIA operatives train their fighters in Jordan, ship them back into Syria to fight the Assad government. So the Islamic State...
Wasn't that the FSA, though? That was the Free Syrian Army or something?
I don't know if they mixed the two together or not. I think they may be at war with each other, actually, because different
right.
elements have been fighting each other for
right.
months in Syria. The more extreme ones want to get rid of the more moderate ones. Anybody who would go to war with the Assad government, I do not consider a moderate. There are
right.
lots of moderates who don't like Assad in Syria, but they don't want to go to war with Assad. They would like democratic change. They would like things that may not exist now, but Syria had a marvelous election. They had a parliamentary election, I believe it was in May last year.
Mm-hmm.
It was an open, free, and fair election.
Mm-hmm.
The Ba'ath Party came out dominant. There was a presidential election in early June. Because of the war, the vast majority of Syrians support Assad, and in an independently monitored election, it was judged openly free and fair, and Assad got almost 89% of the vote. So it shows the Syrians want him to be president. As long as the war goes on, they can't imagine anybody else leading them. But they want a chance to choose their own leaders, their own governments, and that's what international law says. No nation may interfere in the internal affairs of others, and doing it is a lawless act.
Yeah, and that you just explained why Assad has been able to hang on, too. Because he has been doing some pretty good things, and he does have immense amounts of support, which again is something the mainstream media never considers and never gives air to. Well,
oh, that's exactly right. I mean, Assad is the bad guy. When there's even a story about Syria, Assad is the bad guy. There's no information at all about what's going on. There's no information about America planning regime change long, long ago, including against all the other countries in the Middle East America has gone to war with, or the notion that it wants pro-Western stooge governments in all of these countries. No hint of that in the U.S. media, Michael.
No. The what I said about either you're a satellite or an enemy, that never mentioned those kind of things, never mentioned at all. The impression given is that we go in to rescue the independence of these countries against some fierce enemy. The only point that gives me pause is that, in fact, there is something like that. This fictional scenario is actually coming true with the ISIS or Islamic State. That is, I mean, you had Al-Qaeda saying those people are too extreme. When Al-Qaeda is saying that, you know, you've really hit the jackpot in insanity here. They are murderers, and they have been doing a lot of killing. and they seem to have substantial numbers. in other words, let me ask you, Stephen, when Obama sent some planes and bombed them when they were getting close to the dam there, how did you feel about it? Did you have mixed feelings or what?
Oh, I have very strong feelings about it. I believe that no nation has the right to attack another except in self-defense, Michael. And the notion that the Iraqi government, in Obama's words, invited U.S. forces to come in and go to war with the Islamic State. Well, Iraq has a puppet government. It pretty much takes orders from Washington.
Right.
So if Washington pressures them to say, we're coming in and we're going to bomb, they wouldn't dare come out with an opposite statement. They wouldn't dare oppose it. I believe that international law, Michael, which also is constitutional law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, I think it's either Article 1, Section 8 or Section 6, but any treaty or international law that America signs on to automatically becomes U.S. law. And the law is very simple. You cannot attack another nation except in self-defense, and the Security Council alone has the final last word. The Congress cannot override the Security Council. If the Security Council does not authorize war, and what Obama is doing is waging war, without Security Council authorization, he's committing lawless aggression. So I absolutely oppose him. And of course, he's attacking America's ally in Syria.
America's ally.
Yeah, America supports the Islamic State in Syria. These are some of the people that have been recruited.
I thought the U.S. was supporting the FSA. I didn't think they would be supporting the ultra extremists. I thought they found those guys too anti-American, and they weren't willing to support them.
I honestly believe, Michael, that the more extreme they are, the more America likes them, because these guys go out and they ravage parts of Syria with abandon, where the Free Syrian Army has done very, very little. The Syrian Army can roll over these people very, very easily, but the extremist fighters are much harder to deal with. So I think these are the ones that America likes the best, and they recruit them.
In destabilizing Assad and Syria.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So they do serve a purpose, right? They do serve that purpose.
And that's exactly what they're doing.
What an unholy mess. It's amazing. Yeah.
Oh, it's a terrible situation.
But it's very rational. I mean, and this is the point. There are people in America, we've been hearing it for all our lives, actually, people saying, what a mess U.S. policy is. What a mess. Overweening, confused, swept up by its own aspirations, well-intentioned, but getting involved over its head, or this and that. No, they know what they're doing, and they do it again and again and again with great success, I must say. Look at the way they destroyed Iraq and the way they destroyed Libya and what they've been doing to Syria. They're not quite successful yet, but they're certainly making them. They pretty much destroyed a good chunk of the population base in Syria also.
Oh, they did, and they displaced one-third of the population.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the greatest humanitarian disaster, at least percentage-wise, and I think in total numbers of any country, even worse than Afghanistan. It's just a terrible situation for the Syrian people. Millions internally or externally displaced, and the situation isn't getting better. The ISIS forces are recruiting more people. They keep coming in cross borders. They have no compunction about committing the most gruesome atrocities, and I think America laps this up. And the idea that America is going to attack its ally in Syria is preposterous. A couple of times I said in articles, ISIS is the pretext for surveillance flights and what I believe will be imminent bombing of Syria. But the target is the Syrian government, and the objective is regime change.
Mm-hmm. So under the pretense of fighting ISIS, they'll be bombing Syria and the Syrian government.
That's what I see coming.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't be the first time such things happened. Yeah.
But also, Michael, look at the other nations that America went to war with, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria.
Yeah.
The only thing America left behind was a trail of mass slaughter and destruction and total instability. Look at the situation in all these countries. Iraq, you get car bombs going on. Virtually multiple times on a daily basis before we ever heard about anything about ISIS. Libya is a war zone. You've got tribal wars going on. You've got the government has no control over anything going on in the country. Again, a cauldron of violence in these countries, and of course the Afghan war, the longest in U.S. history, and America intends permanent occupation. They're going to pull most of its forces out, but they've got super bases, and they're not going to give those up. And Obama wants 10 or 20,000 U.S. troops remaining. As long as there are any U.S. forces on Afghan soil, that war will continue. It could go on for another decade.
Another country whose population seems to be at war with American power and Pentagon power is the United States itself. We have the militarization of the police forces.
Yes.
And I thought it was a very interesting Senate hearing yesterday or the day before, where Rand Paul himself, now here's a right-wing libertarian I have no use for, really, but he did raise questions with the Pentagon official and said, why did you give 12,000 bayonets to American police all around the country? We have now police forces in this country that are armed and equipped by like armies. Their job is supposed to regulate the peace and security of the population, not to intimidate and act like an occupying force. And they just swagger around, and they're so fearless because, I mean, they face these people who have no arms, unarmed, nothing, maybe a rock to throw or something, and they can swagger about, and there they are, each one of them a Darth Vader, you know, with a shield, a helmet, a face, plastic face cover, a flashbang, grenades, tasers, sprays, assault rifles. What are they doing with assault rifles, semi-automatics, Humvees and armored trucks, bigger than tanks, with a man perched up on top with a machine gun, which he's scoping the crowd. And what's the crowd doing? The crowd is standing there, civilians, with little signs saying, we want democracy, we want justice, for Michael Brown or whoever is the latest victim of a trigger-happy, crazy cop. So we have this kind of process of intimidation going on, these SWAT forces that can't even find the correct address that they're supposed to be smashing down and hitting doors with. So Rand Paul, I thought it was a really good point. The Pentagon official said, I would have to look into this. I do not know exactly what the function of the bayonets were. And Ron Paul said, well, I know. It's none. There's no use and no right for those things to have been distributed to police. And I think it's part of the whole same thing of covering the globe with U.S. bases. You also you have to cover the home base most definitely. Because if things go wrong at the home base, then there goes the empire.
There goes the empire, Michael.
Well, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does this empire get its enormous wealth from? How does it support 700 military bases and armies and fleets and every ocean? And it does that on our tax money. It's the money. Dwight Eisenhower said it with that military-industrial complex. Every bomb, every gun is one less bit of morsel of food or whatever else that's needed at home. The empire feeds off the republic, and we have an impoverished republic. You know, people keep saying the empire is in decline. I see no evidence of decline. They're opening more military bases. They've extended their troops further and further. They've destroyed 3 or 4 more countries that were showing signs of independence. The empire is doing very well. People getting all confused. It's the republic that's declining, the base of the empire. Then that is true, but it's really going down. You go all around this country and you find city councils and state legislatures, and they're all broke. They're all in debt. They're all cutting back on programs. They're all cutting back on upkeep of the infrastructure. We have roads and tunnels and bridges that are still desperately needing repairs. We have public schools that are getting defunded. Well, that's fine with them. They want to see public schools done away with. They want everything privatized, and they found a way to privatize all sorts of things here in the U.S. They privatize it by defunding it, and they defund it, and then it doesn't work anymore. The post office is another example, and this was the largest employer of unionized workers, you know, and now it's getting pretty much defunded. So their goal is really to privatize the whole country, to destroy the public sector, and to strip it and use that money to support an empire so that multinational corporations can have complete access to the land, the labor, and the resources and the markets of other countries, other places, and get richer and richer while the rest of us get poorer and poorer and work harder and harder for less. And the economy and the ecology and the environment, meanwhile, goes to hell. And it's treated like a disposable, limitless resource. It's not limitless, and the effects are just not infinitely disposable. They pile up, and we can have terrible, terrible reactions. So,
yeah, I agree with you, Michael. I absolutely agree. Certainly the American juggernaut, in terms of its muscle flexing, both internally and externally, There is nothing in the world that can match it. But, of course, if there was a confrontation with Russia, you don't need a heck of a lot of nuclear weapons to destroy planet Earth is the simplest way to say it. But America's military machine and militarism at a local level, state and local, really is probably stronger than ever.
Correct. That's exactly my position, that the empire is stronger than ever. And the weakness, the twilight, the folly that they're seeing is what's happening to the republic and what's happening to the quality of our lives. America was never a great, everlasting, prosperous country. Its prosperity, what we know of its prosperity, was something that came from about 1946, 47 to about the early 1980s. And ever since the 80s, it's been rolling it back and trimming it down. And it's been greater inequality in wealth and in earnings and greater poverty for the many and more wealth for the very, very few. It's less than 1%. It's about 0.01, 1/100 of 100%. You know, 1% of 1% is what really, those are the people who really make the super funds, and they're making it like crazy. And meanwhile, wages have gone flat or they're receding in terms of real buying power. We saw this just this week, Stephen, about 300-400 actual Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's and Burger Kings. The workers, thousands of them, thousands of coordinated action went out on strike, and are telling the rulers that be that we can't live. Who can live on $8 an hour or $7 an hour, and even $9 or $10 an hour is nothing. So we do have people fighting back. I just mentioned that datum only as a measure of the extremism, the desperation of we have this land of prosperity. You're talking about a land of prosperity, and you're talking about third world wages is really what they're getting. And the woman who dropped dead, you saw with exhaustion because she was working four jobs and averaging about 2 hours sleep a night, and her body gave way. That's a story that you might come out of, we think should come out only out of Bangladesh or someplace. Well, no, it's happening right here in the U.S. That is I predicted this back in 1990, or I guess it was 91, too. I'm trying to remember when. Actually, it was when George Herbert Walker Bush, the old man, was still president. The end of, I guess that was 89 or so. But I said the goal of George Herbert Walker Bush was that, now this is the father, so was the third worldization of America. And that definitely is what it is. The third worldization now of every place of the entire world. But we live in a third world country. I mean, there's still a high glut of commodity consumption and such to cloak over and hide the fact that people are in crisis. I mean, I know so many people, and not just working class people, middle class, college educated people who are drowning in debt, having problems as far as not getting evicted from their rental homes and losing their houses, the mortgage payments, this, that, the other thing, job problems, no job problem. And there's more and more and more. And I'm sitting here in this very prosperous economy called Berkeley, California, very expensive economy. And I'm just thinking of acquaintances that I know who are all of them living right on the edge, you know. And in fact, you're talking to one right now that if I live too long, I may just run out of savings and I, and that'll be terrible. I may end up on your doorstep, Stephen. So
well,
just
Michael, you'd be
yourself.
Welcome anytime, but I understand the problem. Believe me, an article I wrote some months back was called "The Third Worldization of America," and there's no question that it's true. America is a third world country. There's super wealth at the top. The top 10% does okay, and the other 90% is sinking deeper and deeper into the muck. And millions of Americans live right on the edge, and they're literally one lost paycheck away from destitution, from loss of a place to live, from enough food to feed their families, and that's the condition in America. And you don't hear a word about this in the major media, and the situation isn't getting any better. It gets continually worse.
Yeah, my partner, she'd be out on the street right now if it wasn't for me. She has disability. She suffers Lyme disease, and she has a number of other serious illnesses. Well, she can't live off the $900 they give her. Here in Berkeley, at $900, it's just barely enough to pay rent. That's a case right there. It's right in my immediate family. It's just tragic what's going on.
It's so different from the way it was years ago when we were growing up. It was just an entirely different world then. I mean, you could go to college on a song. You didn't have to borrow money, have to borrow money, it was a very small amount. There were no student loan rip-offs. There were jobs available when you got out of school.
There were no beggars in the street. I mean, an occasional wino or something, a real defeated guy, poor guy, be in a doorway or something. Very rarely. Now, you'll run into three or four or something if you take a walk to downtown or something. It's becoming a beggar country. Yeah. Talk about the upper quintile, the upper 20%. The upper 20% does this well and makes three times more than the lowest 20%. Well, 20% is not the measure of the affluent class in America. It's the fraction of 1%. As I said before, 1% of 1%, and that's where you get into the huge money. That's where you get into the stratospheric money. The upper 20%. I mean, if you make $80,000, you're in the upper 20%. You know. That, and you're called affluent or rich, and that's not a very good measure of population and the earnings.
Well, the affluent.
Do we have any other good news to deliver to your listeners?
Well, I get asked every now and then, why don't you write something good going on? And the answer I always give is, when I find it, I will.
Well, here's the good things. I mean, people are organizing and trying to fight back. When you have a DA do something like that, you know, the other day, as I've mentioned this twice already, I shouldn't say it again, but saying that we are in an ecological momentous crisis here, and that's what has to be attended to. And we're facing a CO2 buildup that really could really back up and kill us all eventually. And we're facing a crisis that's right now in our lifetimes, and it's very hard to get that through to people. There are a lot of distractions to keep you away from that. You got Fox Network that works full time to deny even the existence of it. I saw a international survey as to how do people feel in various countries regarding climate changes, and are these climate changes human-made? And 93% of the people in China thinks that it is happening, and it is human-made. And then there were different percentages going down a little bit in other countries, but the lowest country, major country, was the United States, where 43% or 47% said it was about 47% did not believe there was any climate change happening. That's just a lot of baloney, they said.
Because they never hear anything about it in the news, Michael. You know?
That's almost half of the population. Yeah, that's true. They don't hear anything about it. Yeah, and there's no real systematic reports. I mean, it'll be alluded to as a name or a little label, a tag or something.
Oh, indeed. I want to get one thing in before we go off here. I've got about a minute left. What bothers me is, on the one hand, polls, at least fairly recent polls, show that the American public is set up with wars and they want them ended. Some of the anti-war sentiment is greater than during the Vietnam War. But polls show that I believe the overwhelming majority of Americans support Obama's campaign to go fight ISIS or the Islamic State, and to me that's appalling. They have no concept in the world of what this is all about and what it means, and how and our tax dollars are going to be used to wage more wars that, on the other hand, they say they oppose. Michael, we're just about out of time. A quick final thought?
Well, ISIS is a super devil that they've come up with, but let's see, what can I say? Then there are angels like you, Stephen, who still light the dark way and bring light to it. And,
Michael, there
keep
are important
good
things
work.
Like you that inspire me to do what I do.
I am so indebted
to you and your marvelous books for all the teaching you've given me. So I owe you, Michael, for whatever I may be doing now.
Well, that's very nice. I want to get that in writing from you.
I'd be delighted to put it in writing. Michael, thank you so much. I look forward to having you back.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Michael.